No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So please join in the discussion by calling in at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype your questions to BBSRADIO and the number 1. Tonight, we're very lucky to have with us a journalist named Kristen Capps, who has just written an article saying that he believes Puerto Rico now needs to push for statehood more than ever. This is something that I happen to agree with. We all know that Puerto Rico has been on the fence about statehood now for several years. But recently, they had a plebiscite where 90% of the people that voted, although it was a low voter turnout, voted for statehood. So they've just put together a congressional delegation, and they're sending them to Washington. And, of course, they've had this horrendous, horrendous thing happen to them with Hurricane Maria. So let's welcome our guest, and let's talk about this, because it's important to the people of Washington, D.C., and I think it's important to all of us. Kristen, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Great. So tell us, Kristen, we're waiting for Maria to come on the air. Oh, Maria's there. All right, great. Yeah. Thanks, Maria. Welcome back. And this is Kristen Capps, a journalist who has just written an article, I think we all read it, on Puerto Rico becoming a state. So tell us, Kristen, tell us why it's important for Puerto Rico, more important now than it was 6 weeks ago.
Well, I think as we've all seen, both the devastation there in Puerto Rico and the United States response to this tragic natural disaster outlines a case for why the United States should be receptive to admitting Puerto Rico as a state, especially when we look at the rebuilding task ahead of us, which is going to be profound, and also the debt that this territory, this U.S. territory, has struggled with in the recent past. I think that there is a strong argument for acknowledging their full rights and representation in the U.S. Congress, so that they are able to rebuild successfully and efficiently.
Well,
how it is that have an opinion about this one way or another? Like, is this something that you've been fascinated by and followed, or did Hurricane Maria actually bring this to your forefront?
Well, statehood is an important issue for me as a D.C. resident and living here 15 years. I have become very familiar with the rights to which D.C. residents are denied under our current dispensation. So when the first hurricane, actually, Hurricane Irma, came through and hit Puerto Rico, it was a question for me. It was something that I wanted to look into. I wanted to know about how infrastructure rebuilding would work for Puerto Ricans, about how healthcare worked in Puerto Rico. So I'm a new student to the politics of Puerto Rico. I will fully admit that. But I discovered in my reading that these issues are very pertinent to the state or the territory as it is going to have to recover from this.
Yeah, and, you know, just let me point out a few things for listeners out there that may not know. First of all, Puerto Ricans have been citizens of the United States for 100 years. They pay taxes, although the myth is that they don't. They don't pay personal income tax, but other than that, they pay payroll taxes and every other type of tax. They serve in the military. They were actually subjected to the draft, and they serve at higher than the national average, as a matter of fact. They're very proud Americans on many, many different levels. So people should understand that. It's not like we're reaching out to these people that are somehow foreign, and I've got to tell you, it almost appears that way when we look at what the federal government response has been to Puerto Rico, like we're helping some poor country. We're actually reaching out to American citizens. They're no less a citizen than somebody who lives in New Jersey or Wyoming. The only difference is they don't have representation. They're very much like the District of Columbia. For years, the District of Columbia has considered partnering with Puerto Rico to try to get statehood for both jurisdictions and thereby make us all equal citizens. So that's certainly something that's back up on the table and something that we're concerned with, and certainly something that I think that Kristen alludes to in his article.
Kristen suggests that in the article that to tie the two together, Puerto Rico and D.C., and maybe assuage the balance of what the voting might happen from those representatives because of their political leanings.
Well, I don't know. We'll have to ask Kristen. Did you imply that, Kristen, or am I, that's just wishful thinking on my part?
No, that's certainly something in the story, and I represent that as a one leading idea about how statehood could be accomplished for D.C. And I think it's really an idea that's born more out of the D.C. statehood movements than in Puerto Rico, where the issue is very complicated and politically fraught there. There isn't necessarily the same consensus about Puerto Rico becoming a state as D.C. becoming a state. So I think when people talk about bringing in Puerto Rico and D.C. Jointly as states, that's largely a question being driven by, if you will, mainland politics. And I present that as a kind of current idea. And you know, to really return to your earlier question, Maria, I think that it's important for us, in those of us who live in states, or I suppose in D.C., to kind of consider the question of what our response should be and what our obligation should be to our neighbors in this very, very difficult time. And that's, I think, really the way I would frame it. If Puerto Rico decides that statehood is the right decision for them going forward, especially after this calamity, then I think that we ought to be receptive to it. And that's kind of the view that I'm taking in this article.
Well, you know, I think that this is also born out, as far as the statehood movement in the District of Columbia, this is born out of the fact that we've seen so many states come in pairs. For example, during the Missouri plan, slave states and non-slave states. So there's this sentiment that's always existed that Puerto Rico is more Republican than the District of Columbia, and therefore, you know, it might assuage Republicans who stand against us because we're such a solidly Democratic jurisdiction. Although I think, again, as Kristen points out in his article, the political parties in Puerto Rico are really hard to put a tag on, are they not? I mean, there really isn't a Democratic and a Republican party in Puerto Rico, is there?
No, there are four leading political parties in Puerto Rico. Three of them take positions on the question of statehood or independence. One of them is neutral on the question. The current administration in Puerto Rico is led by the new Progressive Party, and Governor Ricardo Rossello is a pro statehood figure within that party. But you know, the similarly popular the Popular Democratic Party is also a strong party there, and they argue for retaining Commonwealth status. So these political questions in Puerto Rico don't really divide up neatly in a way that could be easily shifted to Republican and Democratic divides.
And, you know, people should also know that now you're probably more aware of this than I am, Kristen, but the independence movement, that's still alive in Puerto Rico, too, I believe. And Puerto Rican independence, you know, one of the first terrorist attacks in America was at the Capitol when Puerto Rican separatists set off a bomb in the Capitol back in the 1950s, I believe. It's been a very, very long time. But there was a very passionate movement towards independence. Does that still exist? Do you know?
Yes, absolutely. The Puerto Rican Independence Party, whose subscribers are referred to as independentistas, is another strong movement within Puerto Rico. And the political question is sometimes hard to pull, although they have regular plebiscites to kind of determine this question. The question itself is so political and politicized that you sometimes see one party or the other encouraging its members to not participate in the ballot. So, for example, in the recent earlier this summer, when Puerto Rico had a vote about statehood or independence or retaining the status quo, 97% of voters responded for statehood. But in that vote, only 23% of the electorate actually voted, and you know, several parties suggested that the ballot itself was illegitimate. So it's hard to say exactly what to take the temperature there in Puerto Rico, and you can imagine an event of this enormity changing some of the political valiance there. And I don't think that we will know exactly how things resettle until the recovery begins.
So I, as a man on the street, if you will, which is, sounds really outdated to say that, I was there in Puerto Rico, and albeit for 48 hours in late April, early May of this year. And I was there with my daughter. We were catching a cruise out of San Juan, and I always like to go and do what the locals do and not go to the Hiltons, if have you, and take cabs and just kind of feel for the place the way that it would be as if you lived there, not as a tourist. And I asked every single person that I encountered, from the cab drivers to the hotel clerks to the restaurant servers, what do you think about statehood? And all of them said they were against it. So when it passed, that surprised me, but I think it's because those that cared about it are the ones that turned out to vote, and those that were against it didn't vote for whatever reason.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. I'm sorry, Chris. No, you go ahead.
I would only just observe briefly that a lot of my knowledge on this is informed by reporting that we've seen. The Congressional Research Service did a pretty large report earlier this summer about the question. And sometimes, for some Puerto Ricans, the status question itself is seen as a distraction, that there are other more serious issues affecting everyday, kind of people on the street that don't have anything to do with statehood or independence. So this is a kind of fractured question. But a couple of things have happened. In the last Congress, the last Congress passed the Puerto Rico Oversight, Management, and Economic Stability Act, which may affect Puerto Ricans more directly as their debt is restructured in certain ways. And then, of course, Hurricane Irma and Hurricane Maria will affect the economic outlook of the island profoundly in ways that I think we won't know for a while. And I'm very curious to see what the political arguments are as the recovery proceeds.
You know, one thing that I would point out, by the way, what I was going to say is, you know, what we say about the election turnout. Those of us who are elected say, you snooze, you lose. You don't show up to the polls. That's really not our problem. But I would say that Puerto Rico, it seems to me, even before the hurricane, was taking a much more serious approach to this, in that the new governor has appointed a delegation to come to Washington of senators and representatives that are like our congressional delegation, often referred to as a shadow delegation. And their delegation includes two former presidents of the Puerto Rican Senate, leaders of the Puerto Rican Senate, a former governor, a retired general, and a Major League Baseball Hall of Famer. I mean, they're putting some heavy-duty hitters at the front of this in what I think is an attempt to get statehood, which is more robust, if that's the right word to use, than it has been in the past.
Well, it's certainly for them to load up their deck with that kind of glitterati, if you will, says that they're pretty serious about this approach. And the fact that they wanted to partner with you too, Michael, and what you're doing with D.C., you've been at it for so long, and then it's like it's a no-brainer. Let's go to we don't have to reinvent the wheel. D.C.'s already been doing it.
Well, you know, we both have our challenges, and one of the challenges that I think Puerto Rico has, and maybe Kristen can give us a little insight into this, is they would get 5 representatives. So it's a bigger deal to give, in some respects, to give Puerto Rico statehood than it is the district, who would get 1 representative. Of course, we both get 2 senators, and that seems to bother the Congress more than anything. What do you think about that, Kristen?
I think that's correct, and it's not entirely clear exactly how those representatives would caucus, or how statehood might affect the politics there. I have read it could likely be two Democratic or left-leaning representatives and 3 Republican or conservative-leaning representatives. But then again, the statehood process itself could change that. And when you get down to that kind of statehood question, it gets divided even to further and further camps the closer you look. Even the status quo is broken into 2 rough camps, one that argues for enhanced Commonwealth status and another that argues for free association status. And sometimes these questions are economic. Sometimes they involve different motivations. So while we in states or in the mainland have a kind of clear view on this, that's very political and just adds up to who the winners and losers are, Republican or Democrat. For Puerto Ricans, I think that the question is just multivalent.
Well, and you know that this has changed so dynamically over the years. For example, when Alaska and Hawaii wanted to become states and came in together, one of the arguments against Alaska was that they would never elect a Republican, and one of the arguments against Hawaii was that they would never elect a Democrat. And certainly, you know, I think every elected official from Hawaii at the national level is a Democrat, and there's one non Republican in Alaska. So those things certainly change over time, but that's always part of the mix. So what do you think they'll do next? What do you think the next steps are for them, Kristen? Do you know?
Well, in the 2016 election, Governor Ricardo Rossello said that he intended to make statehood, you know, one of the driving focuses of his administration. There was some debate in Puerto Rico whether his election actually really gave him that kind of mandate. A lot of people on both sides say that they were voting for different or much more local issues. But you know, he kind of said that he was going to make that his focus. However, now, after Hurricanes Irma and Maria, I cannot imagine that he will be able to make progress on any issue except the recovery going forward. And that is just an enormous, almost unfathomable task. One early estimate for the damage of Hurricane Maria was, you know, $72 billion. That's as much as the debt that was assumed to be, you know, so destructive to the economy there. And, you know, I think that the one accurate thing that President Donald Trump has said about Puerto Rico is that leaders there and leaders here are going to have to work together to figure out what the recovery is going to look at and how that enormous debt really plays into the question. Now, what he means about that, I could not tell you, but I imagine that the next steps are going to be figuring out just how to recover, and then what that means is hard to say now.
Well, you know, given that interchange between, for example, the president and the mayor, do you think that they're going to feel, you know, don't you think that raises the stakes for them, that they're already starting to make the argument that they're being ignored because of their status, so that one dovetails? I know that we feel here in the district that we have several problems at the national level that impact on us because we're not a state. Don't you think that Puerto Rico is going to feel more of that now, given the fact that they feel, you know, whether the response from the federal government has been appropriate or not? They obviously, the political people down there feel that it hasn't.
Well, it's hard to imagine the insults that Puerto Ricans must be feeling after the injury that they have sustained. I don't know what form that frustration will take. The Puerto Rican Independence Party is not very well represented in the current legislature there. I don't know if you would see, you know, support for independence spike, and I don't know if you would see necessarily support for statehood spike as a route out of their current dilemma, but I imagine that the recovery process is going to be painful. So it is necessarily going to invoke those kind of status politics that really kind of hover over everything, often in the background. Maybe will be brought, you know, much more to the foreground.
So interestingly enough, I haven't heard any conversation about the U.S. Virgin Islands.
Well, that's
we've got the National Guard there, but I haven't heard anything. And they're just east of Puerto Rico. Surely they were nearly as devastated.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm just curious about where are they in all of this.
Well, I don't know what Kristen wants to say about that, but they have never, you know, with our interaction as a territory with them, and, you know, they're one of several territories. Guam is also a territory that came in with Puerto Rico, and there are others. But the Virgin Islands have never sought statehood status, as far as I know, and on any serious level.
I'm just curious, too, about the response to their needs, because they're an island. I mean, that's the thing what I understand and am more sensitive to about Puerto Rico. We've never had an island that we've had to rescue, really, like this, because people keep talking about Harvey and Irma, but that was where people can drive there from other states, and you don't need ships and you don't need airplanes to get first responders there. That's the real challenge I see logistically with Puerto Rico.
Yes. So the challenge for the recovery is the same for the Virgin Islands, and you know, it was really exacerbated by the fact that it was hard to get any information. I mean, I remember after the first hurricane hit, looking for a byline story that was actually from the Virgin Islands. There just weren't any reports. The newspapers there I'm told frequently update PDF versions of the actual print news edition to their website. So it was just really difficult to just find out what conditions were like. And early on, there were some very grim horror stories that I think proved to be exaggerated about looting and violence and so on. We can be sure that the recovery is going to be difficult in both the Virgin Islands and in Puerto Rico. But as the senator said, the politics in the Virgin Islands, I think, are different. I don't think that there is a profound statehood movement there like there is in Puerto Rico. And that has to do with, I think, several factors, one just being the size of the population and the size of the economy is very different. So the status question strikes them in a different way when we're talking about things like healthcare, for example, and the way that healthcare costs are refunded to the people who live in territories. So I would, for my purposes, I think that if the Virgin Islands were, if their residents there were to suddenly say, with this recovery, the only way we're going to actually effectively manage it is through statehood, because then we'll be able to vote for things like infrastructure bills and all of the other issues that are going to come up, all the recovery issues that are going to come up, then I think that we should be receptive to that argument as mainland citizens of states and the District of Columbia.
Yeah, I agree with that. And you know, and that, I mean, that really does beg that question, Maria. Will this now change the attitude of the American Virgin Islands, the U.S. Virgin Islands, on seeking statehood? Maybe, yeah, maybe Kristen is right. As we go through the recovery process, maybe their attitudes will change. Necessity is also the mother of political invention, I believe. So, we may see a movement start to arise there as well. What else can you tell? What else do you want to add, Kristen? Is there something else you want to tell us that we haven't covered?
Well, I think that one of the really important issues is going to be the response from Congress, both to Puerto Rico's debt and how that will be factored into the recovery and the recovery itself. Critics have said that the response so far has been, by the Trump administration, has been anemic and slow to proceed. There are going to be bills that definitely affect the recovery going forward, from on everything from statehood to health care to tax reform, and the notion that you know, private philanthropy alone can affect recovery at just such a distance is proving to be obviously not the case. And the idea that U.S. citizens will decide the shape and the law guiding the recovery without really inviting Puerto Ricans in to vote on the law is noxious. As any resident of the District of Columbia knows, it's infuriating to be subject to laws that you don't get a say in. Those are two things that I'm thinking about, and that I think that all of us should be thinking about as we look to find ways to help out our neighbors in Puerto Rico.
Well, and you know, you bring up healthcare and tax reform, two very important things, and tax reform being the next thing that seems to be up on the agenda, and the Congress wanting and the administration wanting to score a victory of some sort. Yeah, this is going to have a profound effect, don't you think? Taking in half $1 trillion in debt between what the Puerto Ricans were already in debt and what this hurricane has done, these hurricanes have done. I mean, it really amounts to a significant amount of money. And since they're trying to pass tax reform without significantly increasing the national debt, it's going to play a big role, don't you think?
Well, I think it already is. I mean, even before this current crisis, the last Congress passed the Puerto Rico Oversight Management and Economic Stability Act, and that oversight board functions in a way that oversight has functioned for the District of Columbia.
Right.
And we've experienced a great deal of trouble as D.C. residents due to oversight, and so this was already an issue that could have potentially affected and impacted more residents as of the last Congress, but now it's just going to be a much more complicated thing, and I think that it's possible that Puerto Ricans may feel that they are left out of the process for approving infrastructure and for structuring their debt as we go forth.
And,
Michael, I think you alluded to this earlier in the conversation, that Puerto Rico is actually a step above a territory because it's a commonwealth. Does that give it any status, if you will?
I don't know that it does. I think there's an up and a down, upside and a downside to both areas, that Puerto Rico would come in as the poorest state in the United States by a long shot, that we get five representatives. That's kind of a downside of their effort. But, and the upside is that we're right here in we're here in the nation's capital. So I don't know that their commonwealth status gives them any advantage, but I would say that when Kristen talks about oversight, this is something that inspired the rebirth of the movement for statehood in the District of Columbia. And I think we should point that out, that when we had the control board, our effort for statehood, which had pretty much died at that point, was rekindled by the fact that we did have an oversight board. At one time, D.C., the only thing we could do was manage the Parks and Recreation Department. The federal government appointed a board of controllers that got to decide on everything else. So who knows? This may be new inspiration for the people of Puerto Rico.
Is that Commonwealth have more political autonomy, if you will, than territories. So it sounds like they've got a leg up. Is D.C. a commonwealth?
No, Virginia's a commonwealth. New Jersey's a commonwealth. There are several. To be honest with you, Maria, I'm not exactly sure if there is any differentiation in status between the two. But
what I understand. And so to me, that would sound like they have more opportunity because they've been elevated to that status, but they still don't have...
It's true that in 1950, both Puerto Rico and U.S. Congress passed laws that kind of made changes to the status. And I think that your reading is correct, Maria, that Commonwealth here is a sort of special and unique category between territory and state. But when we actually get down to what the distinction really is, it can be a little bit difficult to say that the Commonwealth doesn't have any particular fixed legal significance, but is nonetheless something like an idea that is true and did happen in that 1950 to 1952 legislation.
And you're correct, because Commonwealth once meant inevitably it was going to lead to statehood, but that has since become not the norm. So
it was
a process.
And we've recently had our D.C. Council change the name of the proposed state for the District of Columbia from New Columbia to Douglas Commonwealth, So certainly there's still some of that sentiment that maybe being a Commonwealth is a better thing. So that's certainly an element. But I don't think legally it really has any legs. But, you know, we'll see. This is an interesting situation for us politically. Of course, our hearts go out to the people of Puerto Rico. I've just, you know, I'm 64 years old, and I don't ever remember hearing, even in Katrina and other disasters, anything that sounds like what's going on in Puerto Rico right now. It's just terrible. And I encourage people, there are several fundraisers coming up this week in Washington, D.C. I'll try to post one or two of them on our website. If people want to go to bbsradio.com and look, we'll try to get those up tomorrow. But I encourage everybody out there to go in and kick a couple of bucks in. And even though our guest Kristen is right, this is not going to be solved by humanitarian intervention, at least that'll be a big help. And I think we should all do our part to see that that we do help the people of Puerto Rico. And with that, let me thank you for coming on, Kristen, and say that, you know, we'll be anxiously awaiting your next article, and hopefully we'll be able to have you back soon.
Thank you so much for having me here tonight.
Yeah, great. Thank you. And Maria, welcome back. Welcome back to our own Hurricane Maria, who is certainly a force of nature on our show. We've missed you. Maria, are you there? Oh, no. Have we lost Maria? Or maybe they've lost it. Are you there, Maria? Hello? Okay. All right. So we're going to talk. We're going to get Maria back. Somehow she dropped off when Kristen left. But we're going to talk about current events and also some of what's going on in our lives. As far as current events go, you know, regardless of whether it's hard to get to Puerto Rico, it's hard to get the aid there, whether the federal government is doing what it can, the perception is that it's not. And this is just terrible. You know, I mean, come on. Who in the world is this guy not annoying or aggravating disenfranchising, I guess, would be a good word for me to use. The NFL doesn't like him. The Boy Scouts don't like him. Okay. Now we have the Puerto Ricans. Maria, you're back. Great. So yeah, what do you think about the president's response?
I always take everything that is said and tweeted with a grain of salt because I don't think we always get the straight story. And I found that out decades ago with doing talk radio on a daily basis. And there'd be a story that would come up and I'd go to three different sources, always Reuters to get something out of the United States, then usually a Boston or a New York or a Washington paper, and then the Associated Press. And three different versions of the same story would occur. And I'd think, it's the same story, but because humans are involved, it's just, I guess, like they say about a car accident, if people are on different sides of the streets, they see different things, even though it was the same event. And so that's why I tend to pause, honestly, now, Michael. I don't know about you. I don't have knee-jerk reactions anymore because sometimes the truth is in the middle of all of that, but it's being obscured by other things that are more sensational.
Well, first of all, you know me. I'm a knee-jerk liberal, so I do have knee-jerk reactions. But yeah, I mean, again, I would say – In relation to what you're saying, yes, we don't know what the federal government response has been to this, really. We're going to have to let it all shake out when somebody stand up and say, yes, they did a good job, FEMA did a good job, the military was there. You know, I don't think in a disaster like this, you're ever going to have people stand up and say, God bless you for everything you've done. I think people are just terrorized at this point. So I agree with that. It always drives me crazy to see some news guy walk up to some woman whose house is just burned to the ground and say something like, how does this make you feel? I lost a family dog, everything my mother ever left me in life, you know, every possession I have in the world. It makes me feel bad, you know. So I agree with that. But I got to tell you, it seems as a politician, politics 101, you don't trash the mayor of San Juan regardless of what she says. At a moment like this, you say, I understand your frustration and all we want to do is help. You don't tweet out, you people are lazy and you're not getting it done. That's what I object to.
Yeah,
you know, that's what I think
I
is
agree with you on that. That's not the time to criticize, especially when they're still up to their knees, if not higher, in water and feces and generators that are intermittently working and food and water and all of that. Regardless of the devastation, all those other after facts, that's terribly emotional. And I hope psychosocial services are able to be availed, because these people are going to have PTSD.
Oh, my God.
There's no doubt about it.
And you know what? My wife and I still talk about the time when we didn't have power, and it was summertime and it was hot, and we didn't have power for 4 days because of a thing that came through Washington called the derecho, and we had kids, and how miserable that was, and how all the food went bad. And that was 4 days. These people are talking about, I've heard things like, they're not going to have power for 6 months. I mean, they've really been blasted back into the Stone Age. Yeah, this is just horrible, and we'll have to see, what everybody can do, and as we move forward to help these poor people. And I assume
and
a lot of
too,
people leave.
So because it's an island, because I've lived through the Northridge earthquake. My folks had a home in Northridge, and we also didn't have power, and I had a baby who needed formula. I had stopped nursing at that point, and it's somehow we got through it, and that was a huge event for us here in Southern California. But we were not isolated in on an island.
Right.
First responders could get in.
I think you're going to see, and it'll be interesting to see how much of this goes on, but I think you're going to see what you saw at Katrina, where so many people left New Orleans, ended up in Houston, and never came back. I wonder how many Puerto Ricans are going to leave the island and not return because of this. I would imagine, my family, I have a sister-in-law whose parents are both still there in Puerto Rico. So my sister-in-law and brother-in-law have been trying to get them out. But it's hard. It's not only hard to get people out because of the airport being shut down and the ships and everything, but they're also 80 years old. They really don't want to leave. You know, it's hard to get people right. They're, it's not easy for them. It's not like they're 30 years old and they can pack up and get on a plane and move somewhere. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see. But let's move on. We'll just have to see how this pans out. And let's talk about you a little bit, Maria. You've been gone from the show a few weeks. We've missed you desperately. I know your dad has just passed, and we decided we would talk a little bit about that. So, well, tell us about your father. I'm sure he was a wonderful guy.
Yeah, and an iconoclast speaks German was his first language and learned English when he went to the first grade. His folks immigrated through Ellis Island. So I was raised with the immigrant mentality because my mother also speaks English as her second language. And my folks were, if you can afford it, you pay for it. If you can't, you don't buy it. And that included our education. So there was no such thing as student loans and all of that. And they bought their houses for cash. And I mean, it was just
right.
that was the whole, the way I was raised. But there's something to be said for that, because when it's all said and done, my dad, when I went into business, actually, my first career was his. I was one of the first women and the only daughter appointed by State Farm, an agent, and my father had been with the company about, well, he got appointed when I was born, so like 23 years later, I joined him, and I had my own business, because you have your own license and all of that stuff. But my dad always said to me that you need to look yourself in the mirror when you wake up and when you go to sleep. And if you can live and sleep with yourself with that head on your pillow, that means you've made the right ethical, moral decisions that day. And I had a client that hadn't paid their premium and had suffered a loss and came to me after the fact and said she backdated her check so that she could get her policy enforced so that the loss would be covered. And I remembered my dad saying, those I have my own set of morals and but it was like, it wasn't worth it for me to do that for her, because that wouldn't have been right. And ironically, State Farm ended up backdating the policy themselves and paying, allowing her to pay the premium. But they made that decision, not me. So it was just little things like that that I'll always remember my dad saying, almost like a Boy Scout. So he's a Fourth Order Knights of Columbus and a 55-year member of Kiwanis and a Paul Harris Fellow in Rotary. And in Kiwanis, I used to say to him, hey, Dad, what do you do for outreach? I drive old people to their doctor's appointments. And he was in his 70s at the time. And I was thinking, right. How old are they? If it's a 77-year-old man driving them around, you know? So my father was filled with philanthropy, as my mother is. So those are the things that I will always remember about him, is the lessons that he taught us, that you will defy, you know, centuries, that it's never going to be old-fashioned to be like that. And I was blessed to be there when he passed away. And thank goodness hospice is, you know, part of our world, because they made his passing peaceful. And it just, that was lovely to unfold. And then he wanted, my mom assigned me the responsibility of all of that. And so he had in his file all, everything detailed about who to go to for the cremation and the honorary military internment and where and how his ashes will be dispersed and dispensed. And all of that my dad took care of. So all I had to do was just follow through on that. And so that was a lovely legacy too.
Well, you know, I worry seriously, Maria, that we've lost some of this type of, I don't know, guidance that you just talked about in the lives of our children today, maybe because it's been preempted by the media and other things that we weren't so subjected to when we were kids. You know, I'm right. A little older than you are, but I remember there were three TV stations. All through my childhood, it wasn't until I was in my 20s or 30s that there were more than three or four stations that I could get on my TV, and I didn't watch Orange is the New Black and mm-hmm. shows like that. I watched Andy of Mayberry and
right.
you know, and they taught wholesome. Really kind of wholesome values, right? And I worry sometimes, let me tell you about this latest controversy. You know, I saw a bunch of DC leaders out today kneeling down in support of the NFL players that are doing that during the national anthem. And somebody asked me about it. They said, "Well, why didn't you go down there with them?" And I said, "You know what? Because I believe that the NFL has every NFL player has a right to do that, but I also would not do it myself. I stand up when they play the national anthem. I put my hand over my heart when they play the national anthem. I say the Pledge of Allegiance, including the last words of the pledge, which are liberty and justice for all, even though I fight every day because There is not liberty and justice for all in the District of Columbia. We're denied. But still, with all its bumps and bruises, there's not a country in the world that I think is as great as the United States of America, and that would give had given me the opportunities that I've had in this country. I've had great opportunities here, and I respect that. So although I agree Michael, it's a right to do it, I wouldn't do it. Go ahead.
About this, sure. In the NFL League rule book on pages A62 to 63, it says, all players must be on the sideline for the national anthem. During the national anthem, and I'm quoting here, players on the field and bench area should stand at attention, place the flag, hold helmets in their left hand, and refrain from talking. The home team should ensure that the American flag is in good condition. It should be pointed out to players and coaches that we continue to be judged by the public in this area of respect for the flag and our country. Failure to be on the field by the start of the national anthem may result in discipline, such as fines, suspensions, and or the forfeiture of draft choices for violations of the above, including first offenses. This is in their league rule book.
Well, then maybe somebody in the league, I wasn't aware of that, but maybe somebody in the league should try to enforce that somehow. I mean, well, look, I believe there's an issue here. I really do. I'm just expressing my personal opinion about the flag, but I can tell you that the first fight that I ever had with my wife when she was my girlfriend was over the fact that Congress wanted to pass a constitutional amendment that you couldn't burn the flag. And my attitude was, how stupid is that? That's what makes America great, that you have the right to do it. I wouldn't do it, but I defend people's right to do it. And my wife was adamant. She was like, that's terrible. Nobody should burn the flag, blah, 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 blah. You know, good old Patty. But I shouldn't call her old. I mean, good young Patty, in case she's listening. But, you know, the thing is, I think there are issues here. And one of the issues that bothers me is the fact that they would sideline this kid, Kupernick, but then they let this Dallas Cowboy who beat up his girlfriend so many times that they've got a restraining order against him and he's in court, play. And they said, and I heard two commentators during last week's Dallas game, one of them said, I hope he gets over this quickly because the team needs him. They shouldn't be suspended. Well, you know what? We shouldn't have a casual attitude towards that either. So I think maybe this will raise some consciousness. But, you know, I defend their right to do it, but I love America and I respect the flag and I don't want to do it.
I agree with you too, but then if you signed up to play for an organization that has that as the rules, then change the rules or don't sign up to play. Just like if you're married and you want out of your marriage, get out of your marriage before you start another relationship.
Right. Don't I agree with that.
Settle both worlds. It's and I'm not talking morals here. I'm just saying here are the rules. You don't like them, change them, or don't sign up to play.
That's the agreement you make when you sign a mortgage agreement, which is like 275,000 pages longer than it has to be, and you agree to pay, you know, on the first of the month, and you get 5 days grace, and if you don't pay, then there's a penalty. You know what? If the person that holds the contract, that signed the contract with you, wants to say, well, you've been a good customer, so we're going to forego the penalty, that's up to them. But if they want to enforce it, you signed on, you agreed, you pay the $35, you know, $50, whatever it is, right?
Right.
Because you've made that agreement. So yeah, I
well, and I lived that world too, because I bought my home subsequent to my divorce in 2005 at the height of the market, et cetera. And then it crashed and my divorce terms changed because of other situations. And suddenly I found myself with a home that I couldn't afford with an interest rate that was unaffordable, blah, blah. And I went to my lender, which I'm proud to say is Chase Mortgage, and I started the modification process right when it started, and I was in risk of losing my home, and I realized that. I didn't strip it. I didn't damage it. I applied three times. I was denied twice. Finally, on my third time, after 18 months, I got approved. But the risk was that I wasn't going to be able to live here anymore, and I was willing to accept that risk. But at least I tried to work within the system, and fortunately, I prevailed. But it's not always pretty. It's ugly.
Well, and let me say, since you brought it up, that Chase Mortgage has been my mortgage company for years, and they're the best mortgage company in the world, in my opinion. But they just sold my loan to Fannie Mae, which I have no idea what that means, but because they sent me a letter saying it doesn't mean anything, but it's got to mean something. Anyway, but yeah, I've had a very good relationship with Chase over the years, too, and I had a very bad mortgage company at one time, so they're
Yeah, I'll be forever indebted. And do you know that Mr. Jamie Dimon, who runs the company, actually responded to me the three times I reached out to him?
Of course, because you are Hurricane Maria. And with that note, I will let our audience go and tell you that we're looking forward to seeing you next week. I am on vacation next week, so we have to decide how we're going to format things, but
okay, no worries, Michael.
We'll see you next week, okay, America?
Yes. And thank you, America, bird. For your time. Yes. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.